to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
They are trying to recover their credibility. They told everyone that Donald Trump was a clown and couldn't get elected. And when he did, it showed that the media just, by and large, didn't know what they were talking about.
The more money we spend, the more programs that we create to try to substitute for mothers and families, the more we actually displace mothers, fathers, and families from each other.
If you don't want to do what the Bible says, that it's a you problem and not a problem with the Bible.
Really, the entire purpose of the incarnation itself is the infinite joining the finite.
Hi, this is Dan up in Washington State. I'm a Lutheran luthier, which means I make guitars, and I love to listen to Issues, etc.
Friday's Washington Post has this headline: U.S. Methodist leaders lay plans to resist vote against same-sex marriage. It's making reference to a meeting, a special meeting of the General Conference of the United Methodist Church that was held in St. Louis in February. What was the decision made there, and why is it meeting with some resistance, even the threat of a possible split in the United Methodist Church? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Tuesday afternoon, the 2nd of April. We'll be talking with John Lom Parish, United Methodist Director for the Institute on Religion and Democracy, here in the first half hour of the program. A little bit later, Cheryl Magnus joins us. She's written recently in The Federalist about some attempts on New Jersey lawmakers to ban the book The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn in their state. Molly Hemingway of Fox News joins us after that. We'll talk about the media, President Trump, and allegations of Russian collusion. Then Pastor Tom Baker of Law and Gospel will be with us, teaching a Sunday school lesson on Jesus calling his disciples in Matthew chapter 4. Joining us to talk about a Washington Post story about a possible split in the United Methodist Church, John Lom Parish. He's United Methodist Director for the Institute on Religion and Democracy. John, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be back again.
What did that special General Conference meeting of the United Methodist Church decide back in February?
There were a few key decisions that I can say are not just it made, but we made, since I was one of the voting delegates there. But one of the major decisions was that there were two different plans, one of which was marketed as being called the One Church Plan, and one of them was being called the Simple Plan. But both of these plans would have changed United Methodist Church law to remove the current prohibitions on ordaining clergy who are in same-sex partnerships, or also the bans that we currently have on clergy performing or our churches hosting same-sex wedding services. The main differences between those two plans is that the One Church Plan, which was the main one really heavily pushed by liberal bishops and others, at least paid lip service to having some place for people who had a more traditional view. But if you really look at that lip service, it really didn't have any firm protections. And the other big difference was that the Simple Plan, in contrast to the One Church Plan, would have also not only liberalized our standards on homosexuality, but it also would have removed our main teaching and also some of our standards against premarital sex and adultery. And both of those plans were rejected. And even though the Simple Plan, which I sometimes call the pro-adultery plan, was, people said, oh, don't worry about that, that's just a fringe thing, not many people support that. Actually, most of the delegates who supported the One Church Plan also supported the Simple Plan in the voting, but both of those were decisively defeated. And then instead, we adopted something called the Traditional Plan, which was a package of several petitions that maintain our current traditional standards on marriage and sexuality and ordination standards, and also add additional provisions, new provisions in church law that will make it much easier to enforce our standards and bring accountability for when some clergy violate our standards on, for instance, performing same-sex unions. And then finally, as the very last major thing, we adopted a petition that for something called gracious exits, which basically says that in certain limited circumstances, if there is a congregation that says they cannot live with the decisions made in St. Louis last month, here is a way that they can jump through a few hoops and leave the denomination with their property. Currently, there's not really any such provision. And if a congregation decides they want to leave, the denomination controls the property. So there's been situations where people have had to walk out and abandon the buildings that they paid for and whatnot. And the Gracious Exits petition is designed to prevent some of that and prevent some of the ugly lawsuits we've seen in other denominations.
How did the various elements of the United Methodist Church react to the passage of the traditional plan?
Well, the reactions are still sorting themselves out. I know certainly throughout Africa, where there is a large United Methodist presence in sub-Saharan Africa, there was a great joy and people were feeling very relieved that the traditional plan was adopted, and there were Christians from other denominations and villages in Africa that were just, I'm told, cheering and celebrating the results. From liberal, primarily in the United States, the reaction has been quite a lot of vitriol, that there has been a lot of strident denunciations of supporters of the traditional plan and of the denomination in general, using language like calling the denomination a carcass. And there has been, I've seen little to no humility and defeat on the part of people who oppose the traditional plan. I'm not hearing people who were heavily promoting the one church plan saying, yeah, we really oversold it in some ways that were dishonest and we were really unfair in how we demonized the traditional plan. Instead, what I'm seeing is doubling down on some of the political rhetoric that they were making before the General Conference that really exaggerates and in some ways really blatantly misrepresents the truth about both of those plans. And there has also been some really harsh demonization, particularly directed against African and Russian United Methodists, that has caused a lot of pain and hurt. And even you have people like prominent Pastor Adam Hamilton and leaders of liberal caucuses that are openly threatening, you know, and also Bishop retired Bishop Will Willimon, who's now at Duke University, openly talking of threatening to basically punish United Methodists in some of these overseas regions by pulling funding from current funding partnerships for ministry and hospitals and other things as a way of basically sort of a payback for, well, delegates from your region overwhelmingly voted for the traditional plan, therefore we're going to collectively punish all of you maybe by pulling your funding. And there has been a lot of hurt feelings on all sides by, you know, the vitriol and the really just hateful reactions from some supporters of the One Church plan in terms of their ad hominem demonization of anyone who disagreed with them.
Bishop Sue Halpert Johnson is quoted in the Washington Post saying, "We've got either to go figure out how we go together with same-sex marriage or how to separate." How do you respond to that?
Well, I believe that is the first time I have seen a bishop actually so openly support the idea of splitting apart the church in such a public setting like she did in that Washington Post quote. I mean, the reality is that I've been saying for a while that all United Methodists are in favor of schism, even the ones who've been saying the loudest, church unity, unity, unity. I mean, the fact is, let's be honest, as Protestants, unless somebody's making plans to join the Roman Catholic Church or Eastern Orthodoxy, then by definition, as long as you remain in a Protestant church, you're maintaining a schism. And even the reality is that the tensions have been such that there was no way, no serious plan that could have kept all current United Methodists together. But what's really, I find really ironic is that for months leading up to the 2019 General Conference, the Liberal Party line I was hearing again and again was to really harshly criticize those of us on the traditionalist side for saying that, look, there are some lines that if our denomination crosses, we cannot live with it. And if that happens, if the denomination crosses our lines, we're going to have to leave. We don't want to leave, but we'll be forced to leave if it crosses those lines. And the Liberal Party line I was hearing again and again by supporters of the Liberal One Church plan was, how can anybody consider leaving the United Methodist Church under any circumstances? That's so bad of traditionalists to talk that way. And now that they didn't get their way in St. Louis, they are, many of them, talking the very same way they were criticizing us for talking.
The Washington Post describes meetings of bishops, of pastors, and church leaders in both Dallas and Atlanta. What, as far as you can tell, is the purpose of these meetings?
Well, from one of the things that's really, there were signs of it beforehand, but it's really become obvious in the aftermath of the 2019 General Conference, is that there was, on the conservative side, there was a lot of contingency planning and talking about, well, what if we have the worst case scenario of the denomination moves in a way that we cannot accept a General Conference? What are our next steps? How will we react? And it's become clear that on the liberal side, there just wasn't the same level of backup or contingency planning. And there was, seemed to be this kind of assurance, maybe driven by people saying, well, all my friends are voting for the liberal plan, so I assume it's going to pass, that they were really shocked and surprised by things moving in a different direction from what most of them expected. And so now they're scrambling to do work they should have done long ago to say, okay, we didn't get our way. What are our next steps? And that sort of thing will, you know, one or two key leaders might have an idea, but it will take some time and work and persuasion and negotiation and talking amongst themselves to see if a critical mass of them can get on the same page about any particular new direction.
If you were explaining this, because you did attend the Special General Conference and cast a vote in favor of the traditional plan, if you were explaining this to someone, you know, who just asked you, why did you do that, how would you say the one church plan was unacceptable?
Well, primarily the one church plan, first and foremost, was unfaithful because it would formally and officially commit my church to accepting the validity of a definition of marriage and an understanding of marriage that directly conflicts with how my Lord Jesus Christ himself defined marriage in Matthew, and really would also conflict with how the ecumenical consensus, including John Wesley's own explicit writings, have define the key institution of marriage, which is not just an accidental thing, but it is described in Scripture as the Christian marriage is actually to serve as a model of Christ's love for his church. And if we do not have a clear basic understanding of Christian marriage, how can we have a clear basic understanding of Christ's love for his church? And it was also, even though all the rhetoric and marketing was saying very different things, it was really an extreme plan that would have had really devastating effects on our witness and our mission outside of the United States. And within the United States, the plan actually went much further than the liberalizing policies that split apart other denominations like the Episcopal Church or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. There were no meaningful protections for the consciences of more traditional believers under the One Church plan, so that in our system, if the bishop was insisting on appointing us a new pastor, because in our denomination, bishops send pastors to congregations, if there was a bishop was insisting on sending us a pastor and imposing us a pastor who was in a gay partnership, even though that would have been unacceptable to us, there would have been nothing we could have done about that, really. And if there was even some of our most conservative annual conferences, which are our basic geographic units in the United States, would have had no ability to say, okay, within our, even if the rest of the denomination has a more liberal policy, within our region, we're not going to allow clergy to do same-sex weddings. If there were a number of people that were probably more moderate than myself that had really worked on something called the Connectional Conference Plan that would have allowed for some conscience protections for all sides and would have allowed more liberal United Methodists to do same-sex unions, but within a very particular domain, while at the same time allowing traditionalists to have protected domains where in which they would not have the threat of being sent pastors who were violating these traditional standards. But again and again, more kind of moderate conservative people were reaching out to liberal, more liberal people and saying, well, hey, here's a plan where we could all win. And again, the liberals who were offered those olive branches refused to take the olive branches and said, no, we want winner take all.
What would a split in the United Methodist Church look like?
That's the $50 million question, isn't it? That is still to be determined. I mean, I think one of the things to see is what might happen and what might be actually finally enacted in terms of allowing congregations to leave with their property. And if some more liberal congregations were to start leaving with their property, that could create a snowball effect, and having others leave and be less of a critical mass for others being willing to stay. In the United Methodist Church, there is no legally incorporated entity of the United Methodist Church as an entire denomination. So it's really not the denomination that owns church properties, but annual conferences. So right now, if, say, the entire California Pacific Annual Conference, whose majority is very liberal, wanted to leave the United Methodist Church, they would be able to do so legally. I mean, there's some things that are a bit fuzzy and not clearly spelled out, but I don't think that something like that could be really stopped. And there is possibilities for, at the next General Conference, which will meet next year in Minneapolis in May of 2020, for some new measures that could even force some of the more radicalized annual conference to make a choice to either recommit themselves to living according to and honoring our standards on marriage and sexuality, or if not, be cut off from funding. And if they were cut off from funding, then they would have little reason to stay within the denomination.
John Lomparis is our guest. We're talking about a Washington Post story about a possible split in the United Methodist Church. He's United Methodist Director for the Institute on Religion and Democracy. When we come back, they are saying either split or continued resistance. What would continued resistance look like?
We live in a perpetual revolution. The essence of our media's breathless headlines is not resistance to a particular regime or ruler, but a revolt against the very concept of civil order.
Aaron Wolf, executive editor of Chronicles Magazine, talking about his presentation at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
We are now witness to the fact that civilization falls apart when its people abandon a shared belief in the permanent things, an enduring moral order established by God that exists outside of us.
You can meet and hear Aaron Wolf making the case for conservatism at our one and only 2019 Making the Case conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. Attendance is limited to 500. Find out more about the premier conference for Christian laity at issuesetc.org or give us a call 618-223-8385.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
Discover a truly Lutheran approach to education. Concordia University Chicago's Center for the Advancement of Lutheran Liberal Arts supports a vibrant, growing community of classical educators. Whether you're a teacher, administrator, parent, or homeschooler, we have the resources and contacts you need to start a child's journey into the Lutheran liberal arts. Visit cuchicago.edu/calla. That's C-A-L-L-A.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Tuesday, April the 2nd, we're talking about a Washington Post story about a possible split in the United Methodist Church. John Lomparis is our guest, United Methodist Director for the Institute on Religion and Democracy. John, before the break, we were talking about what a split in the United Methodist Church would look like. There are those who are saying it's either split or continued resistance. What would ongoing resistance to the February decision look like?
Well, I mean, those are the two things that liberal leaders are talking about, split or stay and resist. And I think that I expect that we will see some test cases of resistance where a pastor does a same-sex union as a publicity stunt and says, look, I'm violating the rules and there's the enhanced accountability. What are you going to do about it? I dare you to try to punish me. And so we are going to, people are going to be watching to see what happens in those kinds of cases. But with the new traditional plan, we have much stronger tools to deal with cases of disobedience, to actually ensure that there can be serious consequences for when clergy violate our standards, violate the standards that they vowed at their ordinations to uphold. And part of the problem that we've had is that we've had this disobedience has been going on for some years because there has not been deterrence. We've seen, you know, pastors do same-sex union. They brag about it on Facebook. They make a big publicity heroes for themselves out of it. And then they get called up on complaints. There's a whole big process. And at the end of it, their punishment is nothing more than a 24-hour suspension. But we have really, with the traditional plan, closed a lot of those loopholes so that people have right now not felt any, other than their own integrity to uphold the vows of their ordination, people have not felt much incentive to obey the discipline if they are actually being openly encouraged in a lot of places. So that's really fanned the flames of a lot of the disobedience we've seen. But then if we even just saw a few high profile cases of this time people disobeyed the discipline and they face real consequences, I think that could dissuade quite a number of others from following their bad example. That said, I think that this is going to look differently in different places, and unfortunately, to some degree, will depend on the region and the bishops. But my hope is that there will be a larger number of regions in which disobedience will not be tolerated, and that the number of regions in which people, clergy, would be protected from accountability as they broke the discipline would be increasingly limited to a few of the most small membership regions in our denomination, and that would be hard to sustain in the long run.
Is there any mechanism if a bishop were fail under the traditional plan, if a bishop were to willingly fail to discipline a clergyman who openly violated the church's rules on same-sex marriage, to discipline the bishop himself?
Yes, there are two ways about that. I mean, first of all, some of the cases of disobedience we've seen in the past, it's important to understand some of the bishops have been able to say, somewhat ironically, pharisaically, that in allowing clergy to avoid any discipline, they have gone through the motions of a process and followed the exact letter of the law while undermining its spirit. Now what we've done with the traditional plan is we've changed the letter of the law so that basically if the bishop is still following the letter of the law, now the letter of law has changed, they would have to take actions in a way that would make it very hard for clergy to avoid accountability. That said, the bishop says, okay, I'm going to go one step further and actually violate the letter of the law. Then at that case, we could use the same standards that have been imposed for clergy who break the book of discipline to now be used in a complaint against the bishop, so that if I saw that a bishop was blatantly violating the letter of the law in refusing to uphold parts of the discipline, then I could file a complaint against the bishop, and if the facts were clear, it would be against church rules to dismiss the complaint against that particular bishop, or to have a out-of-court settlement that did not involve me in the negotiations, me as the person who filed the complaint. And so there are those things and some other tools that would, basically all the new accountability tools that apply to other clergy would also apply to complaints against bishops. But then there is another level, and this thing is, it gets into another question, but it is being reviewed by the denomination Supreme Court, the Judicial Council. But there was something that was passed in the traditional plan that would say that for complaints against bishops, there is a way that they could also be reviewed by the Global Council of Bishops, so that if you had, for instance, the Western jurisdiction, which is the most liberal region of the denomination, which is only about 2% of the denomination's members, but it's the western third of the United States. It's geographically huge with very few people. That if a bishop there in that region were to violate our standards on sexuality and nobody in that region was willing to hold the bishop accountable for that, as has been the case for some years in that region, then under the traditional plan, under this one part that's still being reviewed by the Judicial Council, there would be a way for the entire global council of bishops to come in and discipline that bishop, such as by forcing that bishop into early retirement.
Later in the Washington Post piece, Bishop Sue Halpert-Johnson was also quoted describing what she called meanness, pettiness, and a win-at-all-cost attitude from the advocates of the traditional plan. How do you respond to that?
I mean, I think that there is, frankly, something I've seen again and again, is there seems to be a lot of projection on the part of liberal leaders within the United Methodist Church. If they take some of the bad qualities about their own approach and they're not self-aware of how they are engaged in some of these bad attitudes and practices, and instead they project that onto others and say that we're not doing that, other people are doing that. But the fact of the matter is that before General Conference, during General Conference, and after General Conference, I saw from liberal leaders that were promoting the liberal One Church plan all kinds of name-calling and ad hominem attacks, all kinds of blatant misrepresentations of the basic facts of the plan. At General Conference, there were some really angry speeches, some really parliamentary dirty tricks. There was Bishop Will Willimon at Duke Divinity School openly talked of asking God to smite any, his word was smite, anyone who disagreed with the One Church plan, and just blatant bearing a false witness against traditionalists. And I just did not see any leader who was promoting the traditional plan doing any of these sorts of things. And again, as I said before, there were offers given to liberal leaders for a win-win solution that would not be win at all costs, that would not be creating winners and losers. And there were at least some more traditionalist people who were willing to partner with liberals on that kind of win-win approach of something like the Connectional Conference plan. But again and again, liberal leaders said they were absolutely not interested in anything other than a complete winner-take-all for their side. And those are just the facts.
What do you make of the charges raised in the New York Times that there were perhaps unauthorized votes cast in February in favor of the traditional plan? What's the charge there, and what do you make of them?
The charge that's being made is specifically that there were a few of the votes that were cast. The number that I've heard is up to four, or maybe as many as five, that of the votes that were cast at different points at of the General Conference with 820 delegates voting might have been cast by African individuals who were not actually properly delegates and who shouldn't have been there voting. And so it was kind of a sort of voter fraud. But I would say first and foremost, if there is even one vote that was cast improperly, that would be absolutely unacceptable. But there's a few things to understand, three things particularly. First of all, these are just allegations and they are unproven. And last I checked, innocent until proven guilty was an important principle when it came to any accusations. And individuals involved have released statements protesting their innocence, saying, no, this person was a legitimate delegate and should have been there. The second thing people need to understand is that things are very difficult for a lot of Africans in particular who are coming from cases of extreme poverty where people might be making salaries of only the equivalent of $30 a year. And then to get a visa to the United States, they have to travel long distances, sometimes with expensive plane tickets to their capital city to apply for a visa. And then it's no guarantee they'll get a visa. And then they have to wait and they have to arrange things. And then sometimes they're not able to get a visa. And then sometimes you have a reserve delegate, you know, a replacement delegate that has to pay the same amount of money to go fly and apply for a visa. And then there's really an issue of economic injustice in our church, that there is really not sufficient financial support for ensuring that our African conferences are able to come and get their full representation and have the funds and resources they need to make sure their people can get visas and get their visas in time to legally have a right to enter the United States as delegates for the Judicial Council. So what has been talked about is allegations that there were some delegates that were denied visas and then somebody from their same area came and replaced them and likely voted the same way the person who was denied a visa would have voted, but it's not clear the person replacing them, or the allegation is that the person replacing them was not actually a delegate. But it gets complicated because some of these African countries, they elect very large numbers of reserve delegates, and so there's not always the records that the General Conference has are not always, sometimes there's just a summary of the first top delegates, and there might be not always, might not be that everybody has the information of who all the reserve delegates are, because sometimes they end up having to go pretty far down the list of reserve delegates. And, you know, thirdly, I would just say this whole matter is really overblown that, you know, you're talking about four or five people that might have voted in place of somebody who was denied a visa, and people are making such an outcry over that. But at the same time, I'm not hearing the same outcry over, it was reported that there were 31 non-American delegates who were not seated and not replaced, largely due to some of these visa issues. There's not the same level of outcry there, but I carefully looked vote by vote on the traditional plan, of every vote on the traditional plan itself and every vote on a substance in terms of an amendment, and the closest margin of any that I saw was 37 votes. So it would have taken 37 votes to have made a difference, but they're saying at most maybe there were four or five, maybe not, allegedly four or five that were illegitimately cast. I think of, by analogy, in the 2000 election, I recall hearing a report that there was somebody that was found and charged with having cast an illegal vote in the state of Wisconsin. But the fact is that because this person was found guilty of casting an illegal vote in Wisconsin, that one person's vote would not have made the difference in where Wisconsin's electoral votes have gone. It would not have made a difference in where the total electoral college would have gone. So nobody talked about, based on this one numerically limited case of voter fraud in the secular sphere of the 2000 election, nobody talked about, okay, well, let's cancel the 2000 election and spend all the millions of dollars to do the whole thing over again.
In the vein of those visas, I spoke with a journalist several weeks ago who suggested that plans were underway to make sure that next time the General Conference meets, those 30-some-odd delegates from Africa would have their visas well in hand and be able to travel. Will the addition of those votes there make a substantive difference in support of the traditional plan or whatever challenges it may meet?
Oh, absolutely. There are, and even apart from that, it's not going to be the same mix of people at the 2020 General Conference. Every General Conference has delegates reapportioned according to which areas have more members. And so there will be about 20 fewer American delegates next year and about 20 more delegates from Africa and the Philippines. And that's even apart from, and then the up to 31 others that are coming from overseas, in which, you know, we don't want to paint a monolith. There are more, you know, there are some delegates from non-American regions, including in Africa, who do vote in a liberal way. But the fact is, in the overall numbers, the non-American delegates are overwhelmingly traditionalist on these issues. So if you take 20 fewer U.S. delegates, 20 more African and Filipino delegates, and then up to 31 additional non-American delegates next year, then the math is frankly a lot better for the traditional side. And even some liberals are publicly conceding that the math is just impossible for them to pass anything like the One Church plan next year.
You had mentioned a few moments ago, one of the decisions of the General Conference is being reviewed by the United Methodist Church Supreme Court, the Judicial Council, later this month. How do you expect that to come out?
Well, basically, there have been the Council of Bishops is launching a, along with some liberal caucus activists, are launching a very vigorous effort to ask the Judicial Council to overturn not just parts, but all of the traditional plan that was adopted, and also overturn the gracious exits provision that was adopted separately. And I have been deeply involved as an interested party, as a delegate. I was an interested party, and I filed legal briefs on both of these cases and was responding to the legal briefs and arguments that others were saying. And there was, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that on the traditional plan, it was a group of about 15 petitions. There were eight of the petitions that the Judicial Council has already said twice, has already looked at as preemptively and reviewed these when they were just proposals, and twice said that these eight specific proposals are perfectly constitutional. And it is really hard to see how they could really not have great embarrassment on the Judicial Council's part if the Judicial Council would twice tell the General Conference, okay, you can adopt these specific provisions, and then we go ahead and adopt these provisions, and then in April or the end of this month, they say, oh, wait, no, you can't, after all. That would just really destroy their credibility, and I think it would also, it's also hard for me to see how they could invalidate the gracious exits provision without really stooping to some real judicial activism. But the worst case scenario in that case would be that things would get no more liberal than they are now, and that we would still be in a strong political position to enact continued traditionalist reforms this next year. But I'm really hoping it won't be the worst case scenario, because a lot of work went into what the General Conference has accomplished. So I hope that if the Judicial Council is rules in line with the Constitution and with church law and with their own previous decisions, then they would at least uphold not all, but a good deal of the things that we enacted at the General Conference.
Then with about 30 seconds here, John, what do you expect the final outcome of all of this to be?
Well, there are going to be difficult days ahead, but even the most diehard liberal activists who have been wanting to stay in the church no matter what previously are now conceding openly that there is no way for them to formally liberalize church standards on sexuality. We are going to see a new reality emerging. We are going to see two or more new expressions of denominational expressions of United Methodism. What that looks like, I'm not sure, but I am hopeful for what God may do with this new thing in the future.
John Lomparis is United Methodist Director for the Institute on Religion and Democracy. You'll find a link to the Institute on Religion and Democracy under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. John, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Blessings.
When we come back, we're going to be talking with Molly Hemingway of Fox News about the media, President Trump, and allegations of Russian collusion. She was suspicious from the beginning after a few moments of credibility. Why was she suspicious of those Russian collusion allegations? We'll find out after this. Nicholas von Amsdorf was the only nobleman in Luther's inner circle, yet few people today have ever heard of him. Learn more about one of the first evangelical bishops in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, Nicholas von Amsdorf, champion of Martin Luther's Reformation. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 and request the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Nicholas von Amsdorf.
Silicon Valley is a place of cutting-edge innovation which radically changes lives, where science fiction is already in research and development. In the heart of this digital chaos is a sanctuary of constancy and reverence, Hope Lutheran in Fremont, where nothing is new under the California sun, where the timeless gospel is proclaimed and the sacrament is celebrated with the historic liturgy that truly changes lives. And thanks to Silicon Valley, you may find us on the web at hopelutheranfremont.org.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Recently graduated from high school or college and looking for a chance to serve a community in need while sharing the good news of Jesus Christ? Lutheran Young Adult Corps may be for you. Lutheran Young Adult Corps provides opportunities for long-term, full-time service for 10 weeks through the summer or 10 months over the school year in places like St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Boston. Find out more about Lutheran Young Adult Corps by finding us online at lcms.org/YACORPS or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Lutheran YA Corps.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Cupertino, California. Zion Lutheran, Muscoda, Illinois. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Dubuque, Iowa. Trinity Lutheran, Paola, Kansas. St. Paul Lutheran of Good Harbor, Cedar, Michigan. Trinity Lutheran, Holloway, Minnesota. Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Worth, Texas. St. John Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin. Messiah Lutheran, Seattle, Washington. Grace Lutheran, Warminster, Pennsylvania. Mount Calvary Lutheran, Brookings, South Dakota. And Emmanuel Lutheran, Manchester, New Hampshire. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.